You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Genevieve Kosky
and
Keith Phipps.
Tasha Robinson has used her talents for deception and intrigue to slip in with the film spotting crew for their Top 10 Films of the Year show, but her nefarious plot will eventually fall apart, and she'll join us next time. On the first half of this episode, we discuss The Talented Mr. Ripley, Anthony Minghella's thriller about desire and deception on the Mediterranean. In this episode, we'll return to Italy with Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino's coming-of-age film about a 17-year-old falling hard for a visiting American doctoral student in the summer of 1983. Timothy Chalamet stars as Elio Perlman, the precocious son of an intellectual couple who spends his days reading books, transcribing music, and gnawing on fruit from the family orchard. Armie Hammer plays Oliver, a 24-year-old student who's in Italy for a summer internship with Elio's father, a professor of archaeology played by Michael Stuhlbarg. Elio and Oliver develop a friendship that steadily grows into a much more profound intimacy. The only problem is that summer ends, and what do you do with those feelings once it does? We'll talk about that after the break.
Mr. Perlman. Oh, thank you so much.
So nice.
Très confiant.
I can show you around.
That'd be great. Thank you. So what do you do around here?
Read books, transcribe music, swim at the river, go out at night.
Sounds fun. All right, later.
Sicuramente meglio di quello dell'anno scorso.
Just watch. This is how we'll say goodbye to us when the time comes. Later.
Meanwhile, we'll have to put up with him for 6 long weeks.
Muscles are firm. Not a straight body in these statues. They're all curved. Sometimes impossibly curved, and so nonchalant, hence their ageless ambiguity, as if they're daring you to desire them.
Oh, to see without my eyes, the first time that you kiss.
Is there anything you don't know?
Boundless by the time I cry.
You only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
Build your walls around.
What things that matter?
White noise, what an awful sound.
You know what things.
Are you saying what I think you're saying?
Feel my feet above the ground.
Shouldn't have said anything.
Just pretend you never did.
Nature has cunning ways of finding our weakest spot.
Blessed be the mystery of love.
Call me by your name and I'll call you by mine.
So, I want to give everyone's thoughts on Call Me By Your Name. Who wants to start?
I'll start. I loved it.
Yeah.
The end. No.
Great. No. Wrap it up. I did too. You love it too?
Yeah, I love it too.
Okay, then we're done.
Okay. All right. I won't go into any detail.
Okay. Well, go ahead. We'll let you go.
No, it's a movie that so creeps up on you watching it. At least that was my experience, mm-hmm. where it's sort of this you know, wonderfully escapist in some ways, drama. You know, I wanted to eat some apricots and hang out with in that house. You know, spend my days a little bit lazily. The relationship from the characters, you know, develops so slowly and you know, lazily at the pace of a summer. It's a sort of generously paced film, and then by the end, good Lord, this film is so emotionally wrenching. I mean, it's, and you feel the heartbreak. You've been through this whole summer with these people, and you can feel Elio's heartbreak at the end of it. I don't know. It's remarkable. I loved it.
Yeah, it's a sensual film in all respects of the word. And I've watched this film twice now, and neither time I came away feeling particularly devastated by the ending. And I think that is wholly because of Michael Stuhlbarg's speech that he gives to Elio shortly before that, and kind of talking about, you know, how lucky he is to have felt something so strongly. And even though it comes with this loss, like giving up that loss would come with giving up everything that it comes with. So even though, you know, we end on this beautiful long shot of Timothée Chalamet staring into the fire with that Sufjan Stevens song playing, like, I can't really feel that sad. Like, I feel emotional, like as in full of emotion, but I don't feel particularly like sad for the character, because it feels like this summer and this experience is ultimately something that has formed him as a person, and that's a good thing.
I think that's an appropriate feeling after the credits are done. But I think in the moment, I can't help but feeling how sad Elio has become.
I just like watching boys cry.
He'll get he'll find his way again.
It's hard. I think doesn't Donna Bowman have a whole thing about how men crying on film just rarely works?
Yeah, or in life. Maybe. But
you're so close to being the Dawson's Creek gif if you don't do it well.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a beautiful moment. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying because I wasn't sad by it, I wasn't affected by it. But, you know, there is that little element of joy to it, you know, that I can't let go of. It's a great gift.
I mean, we're kind of skipping ahead in a way to get to the Stuhlbarg speech, because it's so important. Everything that he says to his son is so great. I mean, it's a great bit of fathering, just because he's telling him that these feelings, first of all, he's validating this relationship, which is not, in that time and place, not a common thing. But he's also expressing what I think is the theme of the film, which is how important it is to feel things. I think that's the thing that kind of carries through from the beginning to the end, and why it's this such a sensual experience all the way through. You really feel this film, and then this character played by Timothée Chalamet, Elio, is to hold on to that emotion and not be left cold by it. I mean, the worst reaction I think his father is saying that he could have to the end of this relationship is to go dead, you know, and to not allow himself to open up to someone else, open up to other possibilities, and feel again. And so I think that's kind of where the film lands. This just, the last 30 minutes of the film just destroyed me on second viewing today. I just was crushed from the moment when they go off together for their last little go around until the very end. It was just kind of crushing to see. And this, in the way that something like Before Sunrise is, where it's just like there's only so much time until the train comes and they're going to have to be separated, and what is going to happen to their lives after that. And instead of approaching that moment with caution, they go through it with all of their heart all the way to the end. And that kills me. I think that's such a beautiful thing to do.
I like what you say about this film being just about feeling things generally, because I think that extends to the filmmaking and its focus on just sensory experience. Like, one of the things that sticks out to me in this movie is just like how high the ambient sounds are in the mix. And, you know, so there's this aural component. Obviously, it's a beautifully shot film. There's this visual component. And it's just like, oh, it's so cliche to say it's a feast for the senses. But, you know, like it does kind of like inundate all your senses, I guess. Not touch, but you know, you could smell that apricot juice,
totally,
right?
I wanted some of Stuhlbarg's espresso as well. That sounded amazing.
Yeah.
after a long night of sleep, to wake up and have a nice espresso and fresh apricot juice. Which, God, I mean, how much do those characters enjoy that every time they're treated to apricot juice?
I should have studied archaeology.
Yeah, it's got all the benefits. But the other thing I would mention too, in addition to the sound, is the camera. It's an emotional camera. And one of the shots that really stood out for me in the film, and I don't know if you'll remember it. Well, maybe you remember it because it's kind of something he flashes back on at the end, is just the shot of them in the town square. And the camera makes a fairly strange, seemingly unmotivated move upwards towards the top of this monument before moving back down to the characters. And it feels like it's engaged in the action. And I call it an emotional camera. It reminds me of that film, I Am Cuba, which has had the same sort of technique of just constantly moving the camera and having that trigger an emotional response from the audience. And that was kind of a small moment where that happened for me.
Yeah, what sticks out to me about that scene is kind of the staging of it, in addition to the way it is filmed, in terms of them kind of circling each other. You know, they start at the same point in the circle that surrounds the monument. They proceed along opposite sides of it before they come back to meet at the top of the circle. And there's a moment where Oliver kind of is hidden behind, you know, because we're from Elio's perspective, so we can't see Oliver. And it's so beautifully encapsulating the uncertainty and the fear and the daring of that moment of what he's saying. And it's, yeah, just the way it's captured, both in the staging and the camera work, a really great scene.
Yeah, I mean, the power of them being separated and coming together as they do, that's a good point. I also really love, you're talking about great shots, the shot of them riding off on their bikes and the camera just holding that shot as they go off into the distance together. Mm-hmm. Again, a beautiful...
And again, a shot where they first separate and then come back together.
Yeah.
You know, Elio speeds off ahead of Oliver and then kind of slows so that they can come back together. There's a lot in this movie, again, with staging, where Elio is sort of barging ahead or barging away from Oliver. And I think it just sort of underlines the precocious nature of his character. And I think kind of does a lot to make this relationship between a younger boy and an older man not feel as squeamish as it could, because Elio is so seemingly advanced for his age. And that carries through to just the way that he, you know, forges ahead through a scene.
Yeah, and there doesn't seem to be anything predatory, I guess, about the 24-year-old either.
No, and I mean, Oliver is very, very tentative, and he is always following Elio's lead. He seems very aware from that moment where he kind of attempts to massage Elio, and Elio backs away. From that moment, he's okay, I'm not going to do anything else, you know. So Elio has to be the instigator, you know, and that is hard for Elio because he doesn't know what he's doing, and it just kind of contributes to this beautiful tension between them that, when it does finally get resolved, makes it that much more rewarding.
Yeah, I do like that little massage bit. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the reflection on it later on, it's like, I was trying to make a move there, and he didn't really pick up on it yet. You know, but there's a degree, to which Elio is precocious and advanced and extremely sophisticated for his age, but he is also a work in progress. He doesn't really know who he is. I mean, he's on, in terms of his sexuality, on some kind of a spectrum of, you know, given that he also has a relationship with Marja. Maybe he definitively goes more, a little more on one end of the spectrum than the other, because he does sort of break her heart.
I think a lot of gay men probably have an experience like that in their past, and it doesn't make them
some prom photos. Some prom photos, right.
I don't think the movie gives enough evidence to make a final determination on that. Just as, you know, it's not often easy to do that in life either.
Yeah, I think the movie is also not particularly interested in defining or expressing some sort of universal gay experience or remarking upon it anyway. It is very much about this specific relationship, and whether Elia will go on to have only male-male relationships or whether he will go on to have relationships with many different genders, it doesn't really matter in the context of this film, which is about these two people.
That aspect of it almost makes me feel really protective of this film, in terms of it getting deep enough into the culture to where it becomes a thing.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I kind of want it to remain this small, specific thing that we can appreciate, rather than being part of the conversation and being freighted.
The conversation, it's always bad. Just
yeah, sometimes it's good. No, yeah. But in this case, it would be bad. And I know this film has kind of tiptoed into that area in a way that kind of freaks me out, but it hasn't quite taken off to the stratosphere yet, so I'm grateful.
People seem very protective of this film, for the most part. The people who like it, I think, recognize its specialness and aren't necessarily, I think, so inclined to pick it apart.
And it's one of those movies that I watch. And maybe Tasha, I know, was not as thrilled with this film as the rest of us. So
Tasha was the outlier?
She was the outlier. So I don't want to say, I feel like suspicious of people who aren't seduced by this film in some way. It uses the tools of the medium to such seductive effect. And if you're, I don't know how you can love movies and be completely resistant to it, you know? Am I wrong?
No.
Maybe I'm wrong.
No. I'm trying to like reconcile that with the fact that, like, as much as I loved this movie, I am less certain that it is one that is going to like stick with me for years and years to come. Like, it, and I think that may go back to just my feeling about the ending and like not feeling particularly emotionally devastated, moved certainly, but not like memorably so by the ending. And it, like, it feels like, the more and more I think about it, it just feels like a very pleasant viewing experience. Yeah. And that is a good thing. And that does not detract from the film at all. But I feel like it maybe makes it feel a little less enduring than it could be. But that's hard. That's hard to say, having just rewatched
it. It's an escapist experience.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm trying to get at. Like,
what are you going to think about next time Love My Way plays?
That's true. God, I love that dance. I
admit I don't come across that song that often on a daily basis. So when I do hear it, yes, I will probably think of this.
You're not
film.
A 44-year-old man with Sirius XM radio.
Yeah, those are some good those albums. That's a good. That was a pretty good period. Was that like the towards the end of when Psychedelic Furs were good? Was that the sweet spot?
Turned to the sweet spot. Yeah.
Actually, that's a good segue to, before we move on to Connection, something I did want to talk about with this film. I guess we could talk about it in connection to Talented Mr. Ripley, but I don't think we're planning to. So I want to talk a little bit about like the period and like how this does work as a movie in 1983, and like, for so much of this movie, it feels like it could be any of several decades, you know, and you do get these little moments like at the discotheque and stuff like that. But what struck me on my second viewing was how the political atmosphere of the era is kind of like percolating in the background. Like, I guess the 83 Italian general election was happening, and we do have some little like hints of that in the background. And it actually reminded me a lot of The Graduate in our discussion of sort of how the era played out in the background of this story. But other than little reminders like that, so much of this movie just feels like it could be in any year.
Yeah, I mean, I think lifestyle-wise, if it ain't broke, you know what I mean? Like, why would you want to do anything differently than ride those bikes around? And if you're these people anyway, live as they do. And I think the film acknowledges that in a very clever way by identifying the location as somewhere in northern Italy rather than any place specific. So we haven't talked about the performances, because those have been getting quite a bit of acclaim. I mean, Timothy Chalamet won 2 awards in our own guild for both best actor and most promising performer.
Scott is talking about the Chicago Film Critics Association.
Film Critics Association. So he cleaned up, and you know, everyone is into Army Hammer and his kind of wedding reception dance moves. what do you think? What do you think about the performances?
I'll work backwards actually with Stuhlbarg, who plays Elio's father, and I spent a lot of the movie thinking, you know, I'm glad Michael Stuhlbarg is in this, but I don't know if it needs Michael Stuhlbarg. And then you get to this one scene, it just brings everything about the movie all together, and it's just beautifully expressed in this long monologue that he doesn't overplay it. I mean, it's just very sort of, it's a strangely matter-of-fact expression of the deepest feelings this man has to convey to his son. It's so beautiful. Chalamet is, it's one of those performances where you think maybe he'll get a lot of acclaim for his next performance because he's such a new face, and you know, this is, you know, a movie he shares with Armie Hammer, and to a large degree, wasn't necessarily get best lead actor, but I'm glad he is. He's fantastic in this, and Hammer's so charming. It's one of those things where it's like, well, okay, maybe it's okay that those big Hollywood movies didn't really work out for him all that well, because he's just as comfortable. He's more comfortable in this world, really.
He's the soulful Jude Law character.
Yeah, I mean, Timothy Chalamet is just so incredible. So, I mean, like, a lot of that, again, I think just boils down to his presence. He has one of those faces that, like, looks different from so many different angles. And this character, like, you feel like you can watch him changing, like, physically changing throughout the movie. And he seems so young at the beginning, and part of that is like walking around in that bathing suit with that concave chest that he just like, you know, you could like break him and he just looks like such a little boy. And then like compare that to him at the end with a sort of like flock of seagulls hair, you know. And I don't know like to what degree that is just like how Timothée Chalamet looks and is versus like performance, but it's just such a great match of actor and role.
It's such a great performance. It's the greatness of it almost eluded me on first viewing because it's invisible in a way. Mm-hmm. It's not showy. None of these performances are showy.
I mean, he cries a fair amount in this movie.
The one point I would make in terms of him is you're saying he does seem older as the film progresses, but I mean, there is a point towards the end of the film where he's in the car with his mom and crying, and I mean what is more a little boy than that, having your mom pick you up from someplace and then crying all the way home.
It's like in Lady Bird when Laurie Metcalf picked up Saoirse Ronan from Timothée Chalamet's house and cried on the way home.
It seems only just
which also featured a sexual nosebleed scene in Lady Bird with Timothée Chalamet.
I feel pretty good because I as well as you all know, but listeners don't, I get nosebleeds a lot.
That's a great year for nosebleed on film.
They're triggered not by anything. It just happens. But that is interesting. Those are connections. Why?
Yeah.
If only one of them were already an established classic film, we could
give
have
it a couple years.
We could have compared them. But we should actually look for other connections, perhaps between Call Me By Your Name and The Talent of Mr. Ripley. And so we'll be right back to make them after the break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So World War II, huh?
Oh, no, this is World War I. Huh. You have to be at least 80 years old to have known any of them.
Huh. I never even heard of the Battle of Piave.
Battle of Piave is one of the most lethal battles in World War I. 170,000 people die.
Is there anything you don't know?
I know nothing, Oliver.
Well, you seem to know more than anybody else around here.
Well, if you only knew how little I know about the things that matter.
What things that matter?
You know what things.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I thought you should know.
Because you thought I should know?
Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know. Because I wanted you to know.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. And one very big thing they have in common is Italy, when it's nice and sunny and seems very, very seductive. Is this the same Italy? It certainly seems that way.
It's different regions, though. I mean, the South and the North were until recently, fairly recently, different countries in many ways. But I think you get a more verdant, shady Italy in Call Me By Your Name than you get sort of the sun-drenched, sandy Italy of the South and Talent Mr. Ripley.
Call Me By Your Name is just much more secluded, too, both in terms of the manor, I guess we'll call it, you know, or orchard, I suppose. But Talented Mr. Ripley feels a lot more cosmopolitan. For like, they're in cities, for one thing, and they are kind of jumping around between a bunch of them. And there's just a lot of people and stuff happening. Whereas in Call Me By Your Name, like, in those scenes when they go into town, there's barely anyone there. And, you know, and I don't know if that's meant to be the how the town always is, or if it's one of those places that clears out for the summer. Like, we don't really get that context, but you do kind of have the feeling that these people are kind of the only people, you know, hanging around. And tell to Mr. Ripley, it's just a bigger swath of the culture that we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, in Call Me By Your Name, Oliver asks straight up, what do you do around here? You know, all his answer is that he kind of reads and waits for the summer to end, really. But that is a good point in terms of the regional specificity of both. But I would say that both films are doing everything they can to emphasize the sensuality, the sun, the feel of being in this,
the shirtlessness,
the, you know, just flat out kind of golden beauty of everything. You get a sense of like the vividness of certain items, the apricots, I guess, in Call Me By Your Name. But like when they get the ice box in the Town of Mr. Ripley and those beers, I mean, you can really just, you know, it's like a four-dimensional effect to see them drink a beer on a hot day. So that's just in both cases, I think, really great filmmaking and really good photography too. They're both quite beautifully photographed.
And we don't see them only, and so we don't see Italy only in the summer in these movies, you know. Like Call Me By Your Name very pointedly ends at Hanukkah, actually. It might be the same night of Hanukkah that we are recording this, because it ends on the 7th.
Is this the definitive Hanukkah movie
between this and Meyerowitz Stories, which does not actually take place at Hanukkah, but I've seen it put forth as a Hanukkah movie. It's been a good year for Hanukkah movies that aren't Hanukkah movies.
This is a last night of Hanukkah movie. All the candles are burning at one point.
I think it's only seven.
Is it?
I thought I saw
all of them and the Shamash.
All right. Well, I'll defer to you, Scott.
But still, I mean, it was good to see that little Hanukkah representation on screen.
Yeah.
It's an underserved holiday.
Well, and tell to Mr. Ripley, like, there's also some scenes in winter, right?
Isn't it Christmas time when Freddy comes calling at last?
Yeah. So it's interesting that, like, winter is kind of when things start to fall apart in both of these stories, or just when things get not so lovely. The summer is a very important part of the Italy component, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of the appealing nature of it.
Call Me By Name is particularly good at giving you that feel of summer and just drifting into this relationship in a really organic, even unexpected way.
And the way it speeds up as you get to the end. Because, you know, their relationship doesn't really fully form until kind of the final weeks. Then they're bemoaning how little time they have left, you know, and that's kind of how summer feels too. You know, it's like, oh crap, it's August. How'd that happen?
Definitely. One of the things the two films have in common as well is an American character and a European character. And Ripley, you have, they're both American, both Dickie and Tom, but you have a visitor from America coming to Italy in the form of Tom Ripley, and then you have a visitor in the form of Oliver, Armie Hammer's character, coming to Italy, and you get kind of an interesting contrast between cultures, right?
And Elio is cosmopolitan. He's many things, but wouldn't call him Italian either.
I mean, his mother's French,
right?
And his girlfriend, Marja, is French, you know? Timothy Chalamet, like, he's got some linguistic skills. I don't know if he's, like, naturally fluent in three languages, but, you know, he pulls it off.
Yeah, he really does kind of go in and out of everything just fine. I guess that's Europe for you.
But it is a long tradition of James Ivory did the screenplay for this, also did the screenplay for A Room with a View, and there's a long tradition of stories where Italy is a place where you go where the rules of your culture don't quite apply. Kind of there's a space that's created for love to happen that might not happen otherwise, and so on and so forth. You're away from your own culture, and you're in a place where, you know, it plays into a stereotype, but, you know, maybe it's more sensual. The blood runs a little hotter in Italy.
I mean, people are constantly lying on top of each other in this movie.
Sure.
You know, like, there's the physical closeness between parents and children, and, you know, even, like, the very first scene when Oliver arrives and Marja, I'm not sure how to pronounce her name, but, like, she kisses him, you know, like, that's just how people greet each other. There's a physical affection built into the culture that is not necessarily in America.
Jodie would love it. She's a big hugger.
Tina Belcher noise.
and there's also, for anyone overseas, for these Americans going overseas, There's always that possibility of reinvention, of being able to define yourself and spin some sort of new narrative that you could not back in your old life. This is a new place. These are new people. And there are new possibilities as far as, you know, adapting or ingratiating yourself into this culture and getting the most out of it that you can.
That said, like, Oliver is incredibly at ease. Like, he never feels, like, intimidated by the culture the way that I think Tom Ripley can be. Like, Oliver, I think, kind of represents sort of an American, like, character type, just in terms of being so voracious and larger than life. Yeah. You know, like that, the detail about him only being able to have one soft boiled egg, because if he has one, then he'll have two, then he'll have three, and then he'll have five. Like, you know, he's just someone who lives life at full volume, you know,
and aggressively casual.
Yes.
Later.
and also just in one minor example of that early in the film is he doesn't come down for dinner.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like the first chance, I suppose, that he has to dine with his family. I'm sure they've prepared something for him, and he's like, yeah, just tell him.
Tom Ripley would never make that mistake.
No.
You are invited to dinner. You show up to dinner.
I wonder if it's a mistake. You know, I think, you know, Oliver's probably used to things going his way and the world bending to his will.
I mean,
a little bit.
Yeah, I think we're definitely supposed to, like, see that as a very sort of privileged character who has not had a lot of strife in his life, and that makes him appealing.
Well, he's good Jude Law. He's benevolent Dickie Greenleaf. Though probably doesn't have quite as much wealth, but maybe that makes him even more appealing.
Yeah, give it time. He's a good-looking white dude. He'll become a Winklevoss.
He will.
It's only
will.
1983.
He'll get all of the... He'll get both sides, because there's only one of them. He'll get the other non-existent Winklevoss's money. One thing we didn't get a chance to talk about in either segment that plays a really huge role in both is the music, which, you know, there are so many big musical moments in both films. We should talk about those, right? Let's go with Tell 'Em Mr. Ripley, since we haven't before. The Tu Va Fa Americano scene, which is great. I mean, because that's the height of things going great with Tom and Dickie, when Dickie takes him to this club and brings him on stage and makes him part of that world. And I mean, the joy that Ripley feels being able to be that cool and on stage and be able to participate that closely with somebody he's already so thunderstruck by, it comes across really well. And I was actually reading up a little bit on the song. It's kind of a clever twist on the song, because the song is about an Italian person who is living off his parents' wealth and acting like a hotshot American. And so it's kind of like a little twist on that song, but it plays great in the movie.
The Talented Mr. Ripley scene that kind of sticks out to me in terms of the way it uses music is a very early scene where Tom is studying jazz, you know, when he's getting all his ducks in a row before he heads out to woo Dickie, and he's sort of educating himself about jazz. And, like, I love the use of the classical jazz divide, particularly, like, jazz is a sort of improvisational musical form, and the way that that is echoed and how Tom has to move through this new life and constantly improvising and picking up what others are putting down, so to speak. So I just love the way that that scene sort of seeds that quality and establishes kind of the theme behind the use of jazz music in the film.
I feel like there's a lot of good jazz music. I feel like it just really, especially when jazz starts to fade into the background, it's when the trouble starts. You know, it is sort of this high-spirited bop, maybe a little bit of edging into post-bop jazz that they're all listening to, and it's all really great. And also, I like that Chet Baker is featured so prominently in that scene you're talking about, too, and he's not, you can't tell if it's a man or a woman. I think that kind of
a nice little
touch for the character, too, and I think, boy, that's kind of telling you that sort of melancholy, sensual, romantic tone of the Chet Baker recording that tells you how you're going to feel over the course of this film, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that until you pointed it out, that the jazz does recede into the background the worse things get for Tom, and the opera and classical that was so much his life before he went to Italy.
He loves that. He's so excited to go to the opera.
Yeah.
There's that bit, though, I think, where there might be a tipping point where he sings My Funny Valentine to Dickie with so much longing, and it's this great expression of his, but also a deeply uncomfortable moment where I think that if Dickie were to really pay attention and recognize who he's really talking about in that song, who he's really singing to, that he would be freaked out by it, probably. Yeah. So I like that aspect too. And the other thing I wanted to mention as well, and is there are a couple of transitional cuts. This was edited by Walter Murch, who's an absolute genius. He edited Apocalypse Now, among other, many. What other credits are Walter
Murch? Well,
he wrote
one of the best books about film ever, which is In the Blink of an Eye,
He's just a genius, and there's a bit where there's kind of a vocal thing that Jude Law does where he imitates the sound of drums, and that leads right into a jazz scene.
Yeah, when Dickie asks why he does that spooky thing with his neck on the train, spooky becomes a cymbal noise. Yeah, that's a beautiful interplay of kind of script plus performance plus editing.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the film is just, as production is so classy all around, the collaboration is so good.
It's not as classy, though, as the way music is used in Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah.
You know, you want classy. That's something, the guy spends his day transcribing classical music.
That is true. That is true. And I love big pop music moments, and you can't beat the Psychedelic Furs thing, can you?
Yeah, but maybe it's just an era thing. Like, you guys are it's a great scene. I understand why you guys are fixing that. But to me, like, the musical moment that I think about is when Elio is at the piano and Oliver comes in and is like asking him about what he was playing outside on the guitar, because of course he plays both. And he's like kind of talking about like, play it like Bach would play it. Like, he's playing the song like all these different ways and like kind of like showing off, basically, you know? Like, it doesn't... No, I think it is an important scene, just kind of in terms of, again, showing Elio's precociousness, but also like showing the attraction going the other way, because I think so much of Call Me By Your Name, like, it's, I mean, you look at Armie Hammer, it's like, of course, obviously he's in love with him. Who wouldn't be in love with him, you know? And I think it's important that we get those little moments through Oliver's eyes of why Elio is so special, you know? And that is a moment where Elio's being a bit of a dick in that moment. Like, I mean, he's still in his sort of like prickly stage, but he's also clearly incredibly like smart and talented and alluring in his way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's got it. He does have to make up a certain amount of ground with Armie Hammer, who's inhumanly pretty. And there's the other thing, I guess, too, in terms of music and Call Me By Your Name, are the Sufjan Stevens songs, which I think play great. What do you all think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was going to say the last one especially, but they're both perfectly used in the film. So,
and that's an audacious choice. This is not some piece of music that's being dug up. This is music done for the film.
Did you see the item go by, like an early version of this where Sufjan Stevens like did the voiceover as the adult Elio?
Oh, wow. I can't imagine. Well, you can never imagine like how a film would be ruined, surely.
I think we landed on just the right amount of Sufjan Stevens in Call Me By Your Name.
Yeah. He can be a pretty divisive guy among music aficionados, right? Some find him too precious.
I'm into it.
Me too.
Yeah. Yep.
One of the things that Tell Mr. Ripley and Call Me By Your Name have in common is, you know, life, I guess, in a little bit out of the closet. You have two characters who are trying to figure things out in terms of who they're attracted to, and being in a time and in place that would be unfriendly to the desire that they feel.
Yeah, I think that's probably a little less the case in terms of Elio, not necessarily the time and place. Like, I don't think 1983 Italy would be particularly welcoming of homosexual lifestyles, but his specific personal experience and with his incredibly supportive family, it's what allows it to be such a tender and heartfelt story as opposed to an anxiety-inducing one. I rewatch Call Me By Your Name with some friends, all of whom are gay men, and it was really fascinating and amusing to me to watch them like slowly realize that there wasn't going to be an element of them getting caught, you know, and like how much fear they all felt that like, oh, they're going to get found out, you know, and it's going to go bad. This is going to go bad. And it never goes bad, really, other than, you know, ending the way that relationships tend to end and that being sad. But like in terms of being found out or discovered as gay, like that's not really a fear that hangs over Call Me By Your Name.
We also get the sense they're in kind of a rarefied circle as well. There's the openly gay couple that comes to dinner and there's no attempt to hide who they are, how they're living, and I think within this sort of protective area that sort of relationship could exist.
Yeah, so basically Elio has like the easiest coming out of the closet scenario, you know, he could, but it's still not easy.
Yeah,
you know,
I think he doesn't really know how his parents are going to react.
He doesn't, I don't think he even knows how he feels yet.
Yeah.
Like, he's
concerned about whether his mom knows, mm-hmm. right? I mean,
she's the one who suggests they go off on their little vacation.
Oh, so you think that Stuhlbarg is wrong in saying that he doesn't.
Oh,
think she knows.
I think he's saying that for Elio's benefit because he would be embarrassed. Because there's like that earlier scene where Oliver, Elio, and Michael Stuhlbarg's character are like, Elio says something about almost having sex the night before, and like they're talking very casually about sex, and then the mom kind of says something, and they're like, nothing, you know?
Okay.
But I think she is very aware of something going on between her son and Oliver. Like, if you watch that actress, like, every time one of them leaves and then the other one follows them, which happens so many times in this movie, like, she's always watching, like, and then she is the one who says at the end, like, maybe Elio should take Oliver to say goodbye. Like, I think it would be good for them.
And it's obvious in the final scene that she knows, I think.
For sure.
And by contrast, mm-hmm. the talent of Mr. Ripley, there is that line that Ripley is trying to cross with Dickie, the bath scene being the most prominent example of just like, if I kind of just say this thing that could be interpreted as a joke or not, you know, I'm going to get some kind of a signal that's not going to get me hurt or not result in some catastrophic scene where that relationship ends. So the threat there is real because Genevieve is feeling it in the pit of her stomach watching the movie.
Do you think that the closet door shutting at the end of Talented Mr. Ripley is supposed to be a literal symbol?
Yeah, probably. Maybe.
Because if so, I like it a little less.
Yeah. No.
I thought when the rat ran across the ledge before the credits rolled, that was a little.
I like
too
the
on
ending
the
of The Departed, man. I think that, you know, it's just well, we won't talk about The Departed, but
it did occur to me, Genevieve. But I think it's not so in your face that it's obnoxious.
Yeah,
it is a closet, though, isn't it?
A mirrored closet, and like, man, that movie loves mirrors and reflections and split reflections. You know?
Yeah, for sure.
It loves it as much as Call Me By Your Name loves apricots and various stone fruits.
Yeah, as well, both of them should. I want to talk just a tiny little bit about both films as being prestige films. One thing that's interesting about Call Me By Your Name is that it's written by James Ivory, who, along with his producer Ishmael Merchant and his co-screenwriter Ruth Power Javala, they own the art house from the late 80s through, say, the mid 90s with films like A Room with a View and Howard's End and Remains of the Day. And there was a certain just intelligent, well-appointed, popular, heartrending art house film that they specialized in. And The Talent of Mr. Ripley is part of that tradition as well, because, you know, Miramax at that time, or really Miramax throughout its existence, did kind of put forward, I guess if you wanted to be mean about it, sort of middle brow, but a lot of decorous period pieces they specialize in with filmmakers like Lasse Hallström and John Madden and Minghella. I think these guys are great at it in a way that so few people are. I mean, I felt watching Talon Mr. Ripley, I just felt such an acute loss of Minghella as a filmmaker, as somebody who's capable of doing a Ripley or an English Patient and really carrying you along in these sort of rich literary, you know, broadly accessible art house films. And no one's really taken their place. And I don't even think Call Me By Your Name necessarily falls in that tradition other than James Ivory writing it. It's way more sensual and arty and kind of...
It does have a literary background.
It's an adaptation. It's an adaptation. Yeah. But I think the director's approach to it is a little not as staid or not as classical. There's a lack of reserve that I think was characteristic.
It's more jazz-like than classical, would you say?
Maybe so. But I was pleased to see them both so closely together just as a revival of that type of movie done this well.
Yeah, I agree, and I feel like Merchant Ivory for a while became sort of shorthand for too tasteful and not adventurous, but the good ones are really good. I mean, I didn't love every Merchant Ivory movie I saw, and I dropped off a little toward the end when they became less of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
But boy, Howard's End and Remains of the Day and With a View, these are great movies.
Yeah. Remains of the Day, never better Emma Thompson, never better Anthony Hopkins.
No, I know, yeah. Remains of the View is also, you know, we could have paired Room with a View with this really easily too.
But then we wouldn't have gotten tortured Genevieve again.
Yeah, but it's very much another rules don't apply in Italy, and you know, it makes you want to, you know, upend your life and move to Italy now just for the sheer beauty of it kind of movie.
Now more than ever, I have to say. The Talent of Mr. Ripley is available to stream on Stars, if you have Stars, and it's available for rental on the usual services. You can also get it on Blu-ray and DVD. Call Me By Your Name is currently in art house cinemas nationwide, and hopefully it will stay there for a little bit. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
I want to recommend a movie I saw about a month ago, but has really stuck with me since then, which is Dee Reese's Mudbound, which is a Netflix original movie that's making some minor waves this awards season, and for good reason. This is a weighty film in both theme and tone, with a story that tackles the intermingling shadows of history and race that loom over the American South. It considers the fraught relationship between two families sharing the same plot of land in the days following the close of World War II. The McAllens, who are white and return from the city to farm the family land, and the Jacksons, black sharecroppers who have been working and living on that land in hopes of one day being able to have their own. This already fraught relationship gains a new level of interest and inevitably tragedy when members of the two families forge a bond based on their shared experience as soldiers returning home from a war that changed them irrevocably. This narrative takes a really interesting shape in the film via voiceover-driven segments that jump from one character to another, filling in backstory and filling out moments we've seen from other characters' perspectives. It's one of those films that you don't really feel like you have a full handle on until the final moments when it all comes together into this incredible crushing whole. It's nicely filmed, taking its title as an organizing visual principle. There's mud everywhere. But the performances are what really stand out here. They're really excellent across the board, but I want to highlight the two actors playing those returning soldiers, Garrett Hedlund as Jamie McAllen and Jason Mitchell, who played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton, playing Ronzel Jackson. Together and separately, they give this film its heart, and both are wonderful surprises in a film that found a lot of ways to surprise me. It's not really an easy watch, but it's a rewarding one, and I've, like I said, I found myself returning to it in my mind in the time since I've watched it. I suggest you do the same. Mudbound. It's on Netflix.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a terrific movie, and it's a movie I feel like, I don't know, Netflix, I don't want to be down on Netflix, but they just don't have the thing down where they, you know, the movies they put out feel like important movies that we should be talking about, and this is an important movie we should be talking about, but it, you know, it skipped theaters for the most part, and it's just another thing that shows up on Netflix, and I'm not sure they're great at, like, promoting what they've got. This is something that should not just be vanishing into the M section after a week of maybe getting the top spot on your Netflix homepage. Maybe not.
Scott, have you seen it?
Yeah. I liked it. One of the things I liked about it was how you could see the full spectrum of racism and the way it works in this white family, from, you know,
Jonathan Banks' incredibly detestable character.
Right. I mean, Klansmen and you know, overt virulent racism, I mean, directed towards someone who was just returning from war. But then there's a subtler form of just expecting things, expecting them, a black family, to drop everything and to assist and to be, you know, just an assumption of the way these roles are supposed to break down. So I thought that was really one of the more laudable aspects of the film, on top of the mud. I think there is a lot. There is a lot of mud.
A lot of good mud.
It's another film too, where, like, that just makes the most out of a limited budget. It makes the right choices and gives you a great sense of time and place for probably not a massive amount of money. So I think it's worth checking out. And I have a whole theory. I mean, Netflix is one thing, but I have a whole theory about why certain films about black characters and experiences succeed with awards givers and others don't. But that maybe we'll have a chance to draw that out another time. I know. Intriguing. I've intrigued you. But this is also
a film written and directed by a black woman, for what it's worth.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully we'll be seeing more of her. And you'll find no greater evangelist for Netflix than Dee Reese. She feels like her breakthrough film Pariah was able to find appreciators primarily for being available.
I may be way off. I just my criticisms are not scientific. I'm just sort of like testing the temperature.
I mean, there's definitely something, this kind of almost straight to video stigma built into Netflix, even though these are heavily invested, worthy production.
This is a top 10 film of the year for me, and I would like to see it getting a little more attention than it is.
Alas. But it's there for you.
Yep.
If you want to give it attention.
Yep.
Just a click away.
Please do. Scott, what do you got for us?
I'd like to recommend a documentary called The Work, which I saw recently after it made several top 10 lists, including Cameron Collins's at The Ringer. He put it at number 2 on his list. The film is about an intensive 4-day group therapy program at Folsom Prison, where inmates and some men from the outside come together to share their feelings with each other. And the results are just absolutely volcanic. You know, many of these men are imprisoned for violent crimes, and you can see how closely that violence commingles with a very base and immense pain that's been ingrained in them since their youth. And because they're men and all they know is to express their feelings through violence, it's stunning to see those feelings come out in a more positive and openly emotional way. And in some cases, they have to be coached on how to cry or on how to move their mouths because they don't know how to do it. And when it comes out, that's a moment of tension and danger as well. I mean, there are scenes where all the other men in the group have to like hold one of them back when he breaks down. I mean, it's that intense. So the film is currently available for rental from the usual outlets. I suspect it'll turn up soon enough on streaming services, and I would keep a box of Kleenex or any other tissues. I shouldn't be advertising Kleenex. I mean, there are all kinds of other
facial tissues.
You're in the pockets of Big Kleenex.
Big Kleenex, that's right.
You can use a handkerchief, too, if you want that throwback feel.
That's right. Aloe, maybe you can have a little aloe in there. But I'm just saying, it's very moving. It's called The Work. And a great year for documentaries. It really stands out. Either of you seen The Work?
Mm-mm. No, I've been hearing really good things about it. When did it come out? Because I feel like I've just seen a surge of discussion around it lately. And maybe that might just be because everyone's making their best of the year.
I think it was buried underneath a lot of post-TIFF prestige films that people were paying more attention to. It was released by The Orchard, which got itself all knotted up by the Louis C.K. movie, which they even at the time spent an absurd amount of money for, and then of course lived to regret that. And
what happened?
We'll talk about it off mic.
Yeah, we will. But I think it's one of those movies that people are going to catch up with and appreciate because it's an illuminating experience. And also, it kind of gives you hope for prison as a place where growth and reform is possible. You know, I mean, because you see it. You see it happening. And at the very least, even if you have people who are there for life, you know, a real reckoning happening with sins that have been committed and with traumas that have happened in their lives. So I love it. The Work. Keith.
I will check that out. I was just following Patricia Highsmith train of thought here. And Highsmith has been adapted many times from everyone from Alfred Hitchcock, who did Strangers on a Train, to Carol by Todd Haynes, which is based on Highsmith's pioneering lesbian novel, The Price of Salt, which she published originally under a different name. I like a film called The American Friend, which is another Ripley adaptation. It's an adaptation of Ripley's Game that was released in 1977. It's directed by Wim Wenders. It's a Faithful-ish adaptation of that book, which involves, you know, forged paintings, sort of Ripley's later career as in other aspects of the criminal life. Here he plays someone who kind of manipulates a dying or very ill picture framer played by Bruno Ganz into committing crimes. And plot-wise, it can be a little opaque, especially your first viewing. I've seen it in a couple of times. Stylistically, it's quite striking. Dennis Hopper is unlikely Tom Ripley, but it works in the context of this film and it allows Wenders to play with a lot of his obsessions he was working with at the time. There's a lot of, not a road movie as such, but there's certainly a lot of travel. And there's a lot of study of the way American and European cultures have mixed and mingled since World War II. And the performances are great. You also get some very Wenders cameos from Nicholas Ray and Samuel Fuller. I think it's really worth your time checking out. It's a film that Highsmith did not care for and then did, changed her mind on. So I think it's quite good. Have you, either of you seen that one?
I saw it in college.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been a while ago.
I saw it on VHS originally, mm-hmm. and I thought it was pretty good. And then I watched it again on Blu-ray They've just done a beautiful job just restoring the colors of it, the moodiness of it. It is, you know, stylistically, it's not a noir homage as such, but that feeling of in a really good noir, of you feel like someone has just made a mistake that's thrown them away their life and then sent them down a dark, dark path from which they will never return. That hangs over this film beautifully. So I would recommend it.
It's also on Filmstruck, FYI.
Oh, how about that? I have that. I can watch that since I'm liberated myself from the year 2017, generally, haven't I? Are you all done with your 2017 watching?
I mean, I still have to see the work, but other than that, you know?
There's a bunch of stray titles like that I haven't seen.
Yeah, that's
I haven't seen Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool.
Have you seen Rat Film?
No. I want to see that. I want to see Beach Rats. I want to see all the Rat movies. I want to see the whole Rat extended universe.
Have you seen Nocturama?
No.
You know, I'm just going through films on my top 10 list.
Does that have
all bonus your next picture?
Have you seen
Does that have rats
Brawl
in, it?
In Cell Block 99?
No.
You'll love that.
Yeah, I know. And I hear it's only like 4 hours long, too.
Yep. Not a minute wasted. And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out January 9th and 11th. Genevieve, what are we discussing?
Listeners who are old enough to remember when Olympic skaters Tanya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan were all over the tabloids may remember their story as a sordid tale of a lower-class athlete jealously coordinating a vicious attack to sabotage a more talented rival. So they may find it surprising to hear that Craig Gillespie's new movie I, Tanya not only attempts to rehabilitate Harding's reputation and paint her as a victim in the case, but that it does an excellent and entertaining job of it. Gillespie's movie, based on interviews with Harding and other key figures in the case, openly acknowledges that it's telling a subjective and contested story, full of conflicts of perspective and memory. And it turns that awareness into a lively, funny meta-narrative that acknowledges its sources and its audience in turn. Working from a suggestion from Twitter, we realized it would make a great pairing with Gus Van Sant's dark 1995 satire To Die For, another based on a true story criminal comedy about an ambitious woman, a bad marriage, an ill-conceived plot, and a desperate attempt at fame. One of these stories is a little more comic than the other, and one's a little more tragic, but they're both savagely entertaining about what it takes to get ahead in America.
It blows my mind that some people don't know the Tanya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize I'm old.
Like these are fictional characters. Like,
do you want me to tell you how old I was when Talented Mr. Ripley came out again?
I actually looked up some movies you might have seen in 1999. Did you see Tarzan in the theater? Was that one you saw? Yes. Ed TV, maybe that was...
I don't think I did see that.
A little sophisticated probably for you at that age.
Yeah, I was a freshman.
This is too much for me. In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The Talented Mr. Ripley, Call Me By Your Name, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episodes, where can we find everyone these days, Genevieve?
You can find me at the culture section at Vox.com and on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Keith?
You can find me at uprocks.com, where I'm editorial director of film and television, and on Twitter at KFIPS3000.
And you can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in such places as the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Variety, and I'm also the editor-in-chief of the Oscilloscope Musings blog, which had a really great year, I thought. And you can find our absent co-host, Tasha Robinson, on Twitter at Tasha Robinson, and at The Verge, where she serves as the film and TV editor. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast, and thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space at her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time.